Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, co-host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I'm here with Nick Yablon, who is the author of Remembrance of Things Present, The Invention of the Time Capsule. Nick, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Rebecca.
So I'm hoping you could start by sort of talking about how you got interested in this topic and sort of researching this history of the time capsule.
Well, I suppose the moment of origin was reading a science fiction book from 1911, called Darkness and Dawn, and discovering all these references to time capsules, literal time capsules or virtual ones. They didn't call it, the author didn't call it a time capsule because that term wasn't in existence. But it got me thinking about, you know, how this tradition emerged. When did people start to deposit things for a date in the future? And I was already aware at the time of the famous Westinghouse time capsule of 1939-40. But didn't know until I did all the research that, in fact, there were as many as 30, 35 proto-time capsules going right back to 1876. So that's the initial kind of conception. But really, the time capsule was a natural topic for me to write on because it's at the intersection of a variety of academic interests I've had over the years. So one interest I've had is the apocalyptic imagination, and my first book, Untimely Ruins, looks at these kind of secular visions of ruination. And of course, time capsules are sometimes imagined as reaching beyond some kind of collapse of civilization. So that was a connection there. I also have interest in memory studies and history of monuments and memorials. And of course, the time capsule is a kind of a monument, a kind of a memorial as well. I'm interested in the history of collecting and collectors and archives. And again, the time capsule is a virtual kind of collection. And I suppose more broadly, I have interests in temporal studies and the history of the future or the history of past futures. I'm an urban historian, cultural historian by training, with a fascination with the World's Fair. So all of these things brought me to time capsules. And so perhaps it's kind of inevitable that I would have ended up writing a book on it. But that's the general kind of sense of origin of this project.
So, I have to say first, I found it really interesting because I walk by a time capsule almost every day that's sort of sitting outside the library in the small town that I live in. So it made me think of that. And I am a really big fan of mysteries, and the new Nancy Drew there's a time capsule that's involved in that.
So I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, there's this whole thing about this time capsule. So it's become really, so I was like, oh, this is fat to sort of read your book and read the history. It's fascinating.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, although I started researching actual time capsules from the Progressive Era and Gilded Age, I also kind of expanded the project to look at things like that. So representations of time capsules in fiction, going right back to early science fiction. And there's a kind of rich history of kind of imagining time capsules that actually fed into this tradition gave ideas and also critiques of the time capsule. If you imagine what happens in the future when they're opened, you can kind of critique how they're done in the present.
Right. So you start us off with the bicentennial. And sort of placing us in sort of one of these sort of first, this sort of photographic, the photographic time capsule. And so can you talk a little bit about this, this first time capsule that you start talking about?
Sure. Well, in fact, there were two. It was a twin birth of the of this tradition, because there was the one at the Centennial Exposition in Philadelphia that was launched by a publisher, Anna Deem, and but at the same exposition, a photographer called Charles Mosher from Chicago presented his collection of photographs, and sometime after the exposition decided, maybe influenced by Anna Deem, he decided to expand them into a larger collection that would be deposited in a bank safe. So there are two kind of figures that kind of co-invented the time capsule, if you like. There may have been earlier ones, but in 10 years of research, I wasn't able to find any prior to 1876, if we define the time capsule as something with a target date as opposed to just a deposit in a cornerstone or anywhere else. So these two figures introduced the idea, and so it has clearly a connection to the centennial and to the idea of looking back over the past 100 years, but also kind of trying to historicize the present and imagine what will happen to the U.S. by the time of the bicentennial. So there's a simultaneous kind of looking back, looking at the present, and looking forward. That seems to generate this tradition of the time capsule.
Right. And one of the things that was interesting is sort of the role of technology, and that sort of comes through. But thinking about photography and how technology sort of influences this idea of creating a time capsule and creating this link. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. There are actually a variety of technologies that might have had something to do with the idea that Mosher and Deem had. One technology was also introduced at the Centennial Exposition. That's a telephone, Alexander Bell's invention. It didn't attract much attention at the exposition, but it we might think of these two inventions, the time capsule and the telephone, as devices for expanding the horizons of communication. Obviously, the telephone allows you to communicate across greater spaces, whereas the time capsule allows you to communicate across time. So I was thinking about the time capsule as a device for communication that had connections to not just the telephone, but also the telegraph and the postal service. We could think of them as kind of postal boxes for the future. In fact, one time capsule advocate in San Francisco 3 years later called his an antiquarian post office delivering antiquities to the future. So there's technologies of communication, but there's also, of course, photography, and I think that's the crucial technology in this chapter, because this kind of culture of photography that was oriented around portrait galleries and the collecting of photo albums was crucial to Mosher and Deem's time capsules, because they consisted almost entirely of photographs. So Charles D. Mosher was a photographer, and Anna Deem collected photographs, and she enlisted photographers to provide portraits for her capsule. And so I trace these kind of connections with portrait galleries and various other kind of practices of photography.
Right. And another thing that I found really interesting is you also talk a bit about how this is also political, right? You talk a bit about the business class and what this means sort of in a political stance. So can you talk a little bit about the politics you also found in these two early time capsules?
Yes, and this is a theme of the whole book, in a sense that time capsules have a variety of political uses, and it's a very complex kind of open-ended practice. It doesn't determine the political content at all. So in this case, we have two figures, Mosher and Deem, who appear to be very loyal to the capitalist elite. And they bring in a banker to, well, Deem brought in a banker to seal the safe, to turn the key. And she was connected to the Republican Party. And But what happens is that neither of them were able to actually seal their safe in 1876. And partly through lack of interest, it took a while to get this idea out to the public. And so there's this delay. And during that delay, the Great Railroad Strike of 1877 occurs. And you have labor struggles coming to the fore. And what happens is that their time capsules evolve into more ambivalent statements about class problems, about also gender and racial inequalities. So they are, although primarily kind of statements of a capitalist elite, there are kind of interesting moments of ambivalence. For instance, Deem brought in someone who Elizabeth Thompson, who was an advocate of workers' rights and a founder of utopian workers' journals. So you know, there is definitely some interesting kind of tensions within those early time
capsules. Right, and I want to come back. You talk a bit about this idea that time capsules, you mentioned, weren't necessarily all that well accepted or people were excited. So you talk a bit more about that later in the book. So I want to come back to that, but. Let's move in. So we have these sort of first two time capsules, and then you continue on in the sort of same time period as to what's happening in San Francisco and the building of this sort of monument to Benjamin Franklin and the temperance movement in San Francisco. So can you talk a little bit about that sort of second chapter and what's going on in San Francisco during this sort of same time frame?
Sure, yes. Well, this is the antiquarian box that I just alluded to. And it's put together by an eccentric dentist and a millionaire called Henry D. Cogswell. And it seems to be initiated as a kind of monument to himself. And he deposited a lot of his own souvenirs and documents about his philanthropy and his great business acumen. But in order to create the time capsule, and this is a kind of tension of all time capsules, they may start perhaps out of motives of self-memorialization, but they can only go forward if they incorporate others and if they open themselves up to collaboration. So he permitted San Franciscans, in fact, quite a wide variety of San Franciscans. He didn't have any class or ethnic or gender restrictions, but he allowed them all to contribute. He solicited even children's submissions. He also is had quite a lot of latitude in terms of materials, printed ephemera, material artifacts, documents about ordinary experience of San Franciscans in the period. I should mention this is 1879, so still very early on in this tradition of the time
capsule. Right, and so he's doing this, and one of the interesting things that you mention also is that his audience is a bit different, right? And so can you talk a little bit about that and how you see the role, how do you see the audience change in this time capsule?
Yes, yeah, so do you mean the future audience or the audience in the present? Right, because there are always, in effect, two audiences for time capsules. But yeah, so he's directing this to future antiquarians. So he called it an antiquarian box, and he bequeathed it to the Historical Society. He didn't say, he didn't give it its full name of the California Historical Society, which led to some problems in 1979 when it was opened. So he's directing this to antiquarians. He's thinking about these sources, these kind of artifacts and coins and various kinds of printed ephemera, but he's also directing his writings to a future public that would see his work as crucial, so that would recognize his important philanthropy and in particular his work for temperance. So he imagines San Francisco of 100 years in the future as a kind of temperance utopia, teetotal kind of utopia. And because alcohol will have been banned, all other social problems also will have fallen away. And so it's a way, and this again is a common theme in early time capsules and maybe more recent ones, they become a way to vindicate your own political viewpoints, to imagine a kind of receptive audience in that future.
Sorry, because this time capsule was even designed to allow people to get water, free water. And so he's sort of making a statement around the design and also sort of promoting something that he had patented. So can you talk a little bit about that invention as well?
Sure, yes. So he embeds this time capsule into the kind of base of the Benjamin Franklin monument, and it's right downtown in the middle of what was called the Barbary Coast, so the epicenter of social inequality, but he also, as you mentioned, puts a drinking fountain into this monument. In fact, dispensed three or four different types of water. So a very advanced drinking fountain with ice for the summer. He actually invented the ice system himself. And this monument was meant to not only convey these tokens of hope for a future teetotal utopia, but also was meant to transform working class San Franciscans into water drinkers rather than beer drinkers. And it all has to do, the backdrop to this, which is not mentioned actually directly anywhere in the materials of this time capsule, but the backdrop is the social upheaval of 1877. So 2 years earlier, there was a massive kind of uprising, anti-Chinese violence, burning down of Chinatown, and the emergence of Dennis Kearney and his Working Men's Party of California. And so this is the major event of the period in San Francisco. And of course, a lot of elites like Cogswell were, demanded, greater policing and more control of working class people. But Cogswell's approach was more to kind of to uplift the poor through things like this temperance fountain. But he wanted to create the impression that San Francisco was not as chaotic as it appeared to be. So there's a kind of slight kind of airbrushing of the present for the future historian.
Well, and it's interesting. He even hired a young man to protect the monument, didn't he? He was a little worried that something would happen to it.
Yes, that's right. And this is one of the dangers of putting time capsules into monuments, or even putting them anywhere in public space, and tying them to things like temperance, which is a very unpopular cause in San Francisco in that period, because it then attracts violence and attracts kind of graffiti. And in fact, a lot of boys in San Francisco apparently defaced it and put rats up the faucets of the water fountain to scare people off. There's definitely kind of a sense after that time capsules need to be deposited somewhere that will allow them to survive the kind of vicissitudes of time and allow them to get to their future date.
Right. And it's really, before we move on to the third chapter, one thing I thought was really interesting in this one, and sort of moving away from this idea, was his also the role of the domestic arts and the role of allowing women to contribute. And I found that really interesting and sort of fascinating to what he brought in or allowed in.
Yeah. Yes. And I think this is, again, another crucial theme throughout the book, especially in these earlier and middle chapters. And it's the surprising kind of openness of the time capsule to collaboration and to a variety of different types of sources and contributors. And I compare this, and I see this as a critique of other institutions of memory in the period, such as museums and historical societies, libraries, archives, all of which were very tightly controlled and still to some extent are. And whereas the time capsule was a kind of counter device, something that was much more open. Of course, there were still exclusions and there were still biases within them, but they do certainly kind of allow for a greater variety of material and political viewpoints and social backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. And so as you sort of talk about these sort of the start of these time capsules and then move into 1900, 1901, when time capsules start to be made that will be opened a century later. And you talk about how these time capsules weren't all really, always really accepted And so can you talk a little bit about that, about sort of time capsules and sort of the negative responses to them, as well as the sort of positive responses to them?
Sure. And some of these negative responses come up in fiction, as I mentioned earlier. And Mark Twain in particular wrote a number of stories, one of which really focuses on the limits of the time capsule and the ways in which they're bound to fail. Yet he was still interested in them, and he still did his own time capsule, in effect, which was his autobiographical manuscript, which was meant to be sealed for 100 years, to be opened 100 years after his death. So sometimes critics could also be advocates of the time capsule. And so I don't think it's always a rejection of it. But in the case of some of these time capsules around 1900, 1901, well, in particular, the one at Harvard University, that was rejected and critiqued by certain professors, particularly professors in the history department. And that confirms my suspicion that there is perhaps a kind of a sense of condescension towards a time capsule as a more populist and collaborative and maybe more democratic form of history. And a number of them didn't accept the invitation to contribute to the Harvard chest of 1900. Although, in an interesting turn, the head librarian who organized that time capsule included their rejection letters in the actual chest. So you can read about how they found the time capsule to be a kind of useless or misleading way of preserving history.
And like you said, throughout, you sort of talk about different authors and talk about their roles, and you talk even about some of the story. You talk about Whitman and what Whitman was talking about in your first couple chapters, and then you move into Mark Twain. So I'm not sure if there's anything else you want to say right now about that role of literature, because I thought that interweaving of that and sort of the way that literature marks memory and marks time was really interesting as well.
Sure. I think, it actually goes back to Edward Bellamy as well, looking backward. In a sense, Julian West's sleeping room, which is the chamber in which he kind of travels 123 years into the future, from 1877 to 2000. That sleeping chamber also contains objects, so it's kind of a de facto time capsule. But there is also a safe in his room, and in the follow up to Looking Backward, which is called Equality, he explores the various items that Julian West brought with him to the year 2000. So some of those are bank or financial documents, which of course are useless in this kind of post-capitalist utopia of the year 2000. So even novelists like Edward Bellamy, who we don't associate with the time capsule, had elements of time capsule ideas in those fictions.
Right. And one of the interesting things you say and you saw in some of these time capsules that weren't happening in the other one, so you talk about, for instance, the Kansas City sort of century ball, was including predictions of what they would see happening 100 years into the future. So can you talk about that sort of change as well in the role of prediction?
Sure. Yes. So predictions are definitely a common kind of type of contribution in certain time capsules. We don't see them so much in the very first ones, but right by around 1900, people are contributing not just genealogies of their family or some kind of artifact or some kind of essay about the present, but they're also delivering predictions, and obviously they are intended to be kind of read and either confirmed or seen as or debunked when they're finally opened. And I'm interested in these predictions not just as kind of attempts to control or kind of determine the future, but more as expressions of hope. So some of them talk about their prediction of a classless society by the year 2000 when the time capsule was opened, or as a post-racial society. And so one of my attempts, especially in these middle chapters, is to recover the politics of hope that is embedded in these time capsules, and the way in which they communicate sometimes progressive utopias and sometimes reactionary ones. Sometimes you see kind of visions of a eugenicist future, one in which race has been purified and the Anglo-Saxon race has shored up its supremacy. But sometimes you also get more progressive visions of the future. So, yeah.
No, I was just going to say, I found it really interesting, right? Some of them were writing about morality, mortality, and others were even writing poems and thinking about or even complaining about their colleagues. But I found it really interesting to just sort of see the kinds of things that individuals writing thought that people in the future would want to know about what was happening or what they hoped for a future.
Sure. Yes. And I mean, these are things that we struggle to find in other documents. There's something about the time capsule that seemed to engender these expressions of hope and these kinds of political predictions. And I think, I suppose I'm pushing back against the emphasis of historians on the past, on the way in which the past is used, the constructions of national past and the way that's used in certain periods to kind of shore up national identity or whatever it is. What I want to do is write a history of the past, of the various imaginations of the future were kind of written about in certain periods. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And so there is, and you talk about it as a sort of idea of a secret history, which I thought was a really interesting way of referring to it and thinking about it. So you then move on to sort of looking at, in your next chapter, that role of the memory of the present. How would we remember? You talk about a little bit of that. And so can you sort of talk about that sort of the political uses of the future and what you're talking about in your chapter 4?
Yes. Yeah, so I stay with these. So I call these the centurial vessels because they were not centennial vessels in the sense of the first chapter, the U.S. centennial, but they were centurial because they were put together around 1900, 1901, and almost all but one of them were to be opened in the year 2000 or 2001. And so I stay with them because really they're the crucial, they're the most important ones for the whole book, in that they have this this kind of politics of hope within them. So in that chapter 4, I stay with those time capsules. And I should mention, we already said one was in Harvard. One was, I think you mentioned, Kansas City. There was also one at Detroit and Colorado Springs and Mount Holyoke College. So a variety of locations. None of them knew about each other. That's an important aspect to this, that almost every time capsule in my book, every inventor of a time capsule thought that they were the first one to come up with the idea. But there are certainly several key themes between them. And one thing that comes out in this chapter 4 is other negative, the kind of critiques of various aspects of the present, to get to your question. So critiques of imperialism that comes out. Of course, this is a period just after the outbreak of the Spanish-American War. And a number of people, all across these different cities, were kind of including kind of sense of misgiving about those imperialist adventures. There are also critiques of the impact of technology on everyday life, the way in which they felt they'd become overly dependent on technology. And then also, of course, critiques of the inequalities, the gender, racial, and economic inequalities of their own cities and their nation. So I see these critiques as being generated around 1900 by a number of things. But one key thing is the confidentiality that is now allowed for time capsule contributors. They were allowed to submit their assessments of the present in envelopes, and they could seal them, so their messages would be unread in the present. And I think that liberated them to be more candid about the conditions of the present.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Some of them talk about sort of, you mentioned the idea of sort of urban progress and industrialization, but also the sort of criticism of the city. I think it was in Colorado Springs where there was talk about city government and how people sort of can't manage the affairs of the city well. And so there's different things like that are sort of playing with one another as well throughout these time capsules.
Yes. So yes, you see critiques of civic corruption, and this is obviously a key theme of the progressive era. But also with Colorado Springs being so close to Cripple Creek, there were a number of labor battles, actually literally pitched battles between labor and capital. And Colorado Springs, the person who organized that time capsule invited leaders of labor unions to come in and contribute their messages to the future. So we see here these kind of very moving kind of messages about fighting capitalist greed and kind of trying to create a kind of classless commonwealth of workers. And one thing that comes out there is this theme, which again I try to trace throughout the book, of an embodied future. So those workers are addressing the future workers of the year 2000, and they're expressing this kind of sense of solidarity, class solidarity across time. And what I wanted to do in the book was to kind of critique the emphasis that historians have had on the way in which the future has been rendered kind of abstract, rationalized, the way in which we fail in capitalist modernity to imagine an alternative future. We think of the future supposedly in disembodied ways or in financial ways. We see the future as the statistical extrapolation of present trends. But what I wanted to show was that through the time capsule, people were able to conceive the future in more embodied, more open ways. And these labor union leaders were a good example of that. The way in which they targeted their messages to the embodied reader of the future. So a lot of these time capsule messages around 1900 talk about physical connections across time, the way they would embrace their reader or reach out and shake their hand. And this kind of very personalized connection to future, to posterity, allowed for an alternative way of imagining the development of the United States.
So, and one thing that you do throughout your book, there's a number of photographs and images. So I'd love for you to talk about those. And I bring it up now because in this chapter, we see photographs of, there's this a stark image of sort of a coal mining town. Bicycles, cars. There's even a drawing of a woman that looks more like it's looking at sort of clothing and fashion. And so can you talk about some of these images or sort of the role of the images that you continue to see? I mean, you talk about it in the first chapter, but throughout these time capsules and throughout the text?
Sure. Yes. So Whereas the first two time capsules back in Philadelphia, the Centennial, they used photography as a way to memorialize the elite and perhaps also middle class people who paid money to have their portrait taken by this proper photographer. By 1900, you see the use of photography as a kind of archival, you know, documentary tool. And so in each of these cities, the time capsule organizer commissioned photographers, but also, you know, kind of invited all sorts of amateur photographers to take to create a survey of their environment and to document the built landscape of their lives. And you see some fascinating collections, particularly at Harvard and at Colorado Springs. You know, a large number of photographs that documented all sorts of things, not just the homes of professors like William James, but also characters on the streets, particularly a famous figure in Harvard who was who led a cart and donkey through Harvard over 60 or 70 years. He was a kind of a familiar figure on campus. So all sorts of kind of documentation comes into those time capsules.
Right. And then you sort of move into this idea of living history and archiving. And you talk about the, in Chapter 5, the Modern Historical Records Association. So can you talk a little bit about that and their use of sort of the time capsule and who they are and sort of what they did?
Sure. Yes. So the Modern Historic Records Association, and no one has heard of this association because it was very short-lived and only lasted a couple of years. But I see it as crucial to the mutation of the time capsule into something more akin to what we get by 1940, which is the Westinghouse 1939-40, the Westinghouse time capsule. So the association was founded in New York as a kind of ongoing kind of program of schemes to guarantee adequate records of the present for future historians. And in fact, it had a number of current historians on its board. It kind of looked to the new history, people like Frederick Jackson Turner and others as their kind of inspiration. And they wanted to do a number of things. First of all, ensure that cities and federal government kept proper records for the future and use proper durable forms of paper. But also they used time capsules partly to promote their project, but also to show how you could conserve documents over hundreds or even thousands of years. And they enlisted photographers, phonograph inventors. In fact, Thomas Edison was involved, and also film. So Thomas Edison's new kinetophone, which is an early kind of attempt to create sound film, that was also used in some of those early projects. So it's about embracing and utilizing modern technologies, but also ancient media such as kind of parchment and terracotta, even, to find a way to kind of conserve materials for future historians.
So what I found was really interesting in this chapter is the role of the modern media, audiovisual, how they were using sort of media in different ways. So can you talk about that role of media and memory and archive that sort of happens with this Modern Historical Records Association?
Sure. Yes. Yeah. So as I mentioned, they're bringing in photographers and they're bringing in phonograph records and film, but they're not using them perhaps in the way we would assume they would be used. They're trying to combine them in different ways. So I see this as an interesting kind of contrast to how we tend to kind of fetishize digital technology in our own present. And there's a big emphasis on digitization and relying on the digital itself. And of course, there are dangers with that in terms of, first of all, relying just on one medium, the dangers of kind of obsolescence of media formats, but also perhaps the sense that you kind of you lose a You lose the tactility that you might have from other forms of evidence from the past. And so what was interesting to me about the Modern Historical Records Association was how they didn't put all their eggs into one basket. They didn't rely just on one medium. They saw it as necessary to have them working together. So for instance, when they submitted a film for preservation, they included a record on parchment describing it. Another thing they did was to combine modern and ancient media, so to create these kind of hybrid media. An example of this was using the linotype machine to imprint texts onto clay tablets. So you have the most ancient form of, or the most ancient medium of all, which is terracotta clay going back to Mesopotamia, but then using the latest linotype machine to imprint tiny print onto it, perhaps an early form of microfilm. So another example, this would be developing photographs onto stone or onto other harder kind of surfaces. And here I draw on the theorist, the communication theorist, Harold Innes, who is kind of one of the pioneers of communication studies. And he has this interesting distinction between heavy media, such as, you know, metal or clay, various things that you could imprint words onto and that would be very durable. And so heavy media he sees as time binding, so binding us across time, whereas light media, such as paper, and then in our own day, electronic media, which is, of course, super light, he sees those as space binding, so allowing us to kind of reach out across space. And of course, we always have a combination of both time binding and space binding media in any given present. But what concerned him was the way in which sometimes the bias leads more towards one or the other. And he saw this period that I'm looking at, late 19th century America, as one that was dominated by space binding, light media, the expansion of obviously paper. And so what I suggested, the time capsule was introduced as maybe a corrective to that, as an attempt to reinforce temporality in civilization. And you could think of the time capsule as itself a medium for communication, and one that was, kind of mixing or interacting with other media.
Right. And so you move from this into, so we take a little break. There's a little dip in the time capsule as the United States is involved in some other more pressing issues at the time. And then you sort of talk about sort of that interwar projects, and you have sort of three projects that you talk about from in 1925 to 1940, so that we're sitting in between World War I and World War II here in the United States. So can you talk a little bit about then moving into this next sort of phase or period of the time capsule?
Sure. So I end, although I continue up to the present in the epilogue, but the proper section of the book ends with the Westinghouse time capsule. But rather than see that as the kind of full emergence, the flowering of the time capsule, or as one person has called it, the first modern time capsule, I want to see the Westinghouse project as a kind of distortion, a kind of corporate appropriation of what was in fact a civic tradition and quite a collaborative and democratic tradition. So it's the end point here is decidedly negative. And so I show in this chapter how Westinghouse conscripted this time capsule idea as a PR strategy to kind of bolster public faith in science and technology and technocracy in the depths of the Depression, as America was still in the Depression in 1939. But I also place it alongside three earlier projects, also from the interwar period, mostly early 1930s and late 20s. There was a Coyne Harvey, who some historians might recall. He was a kind of agrarian populist, famous in 1896. During the election, he retired to his property in Montenay, Arkansas, and created a, or started to create a pyramid, 130-foot pyramid, that was going to be stocked with records for some future civilization. So I look at that one, and also a project in Denver in the early 1930s to create massive records, a massive collection of records for future civilization. And that was deposited in a concrete, in actually two concrete mausoleums. And then finally, the third one is the Crypt of Civilization, which was assembled in Atlanta at Oglethorpe University. So these three less well-known examples of time capsules bring into view some of the more troubling aspects of the time capsule tradition by the 1930s, the emphasis on technocracy, on eugenics. Although eugenics was a theme throughout the book, it becomes much more prevalent by the 1930s, with all four of these projects being very closely tied to visions of a purified future race. And also, I think another troubling thing which I emphasize here is this kind of depersonalized conception of posterity. In fact, the whole book is not just a history of time capsules, and I do want to kind of emphasize that I wanted to write that history, but also tie the time capsule to broader themes. And one of those, perhaps the most important one, is the issue of posterity and how we relate to future generations. And going back to the conception of my book, I was thinking about how how obviously a number of scholars and philosophers, legal theorists have tried to kind of construct an ethics of posterity that would allow us to respect the rights of future generations. This is obviously crucial in our moment of crisis with climate change. And although I read a lot of that work, I felt that it's not enough just to have legal and philosophical arguments about the rights of posterity. We need to also foster an effective connection, emotional connection with unborn generations of the future. And so I see the time capsule as a device that has tried to do that with greater or less success. And in fact, but going back to 1900, there was an organizer of a time capsule in Colorado Springs who coined the term posteritism to define how this time capsule was to inculcate a sense of respect and love of future generations. So what I've tried to do in the book is trace a history of the idea of posterity through this time capsule tradition. And I found that although there's abuses of the rhetoric of posterity across all these different chapters, the ways in which people invoke posterity to justify kind of capitalist oppression or various other things, there is, at least in around 1900, a sense of an embodied relationship to the future recipient of the time capsule, and a sense of being able to kind of embrace one another over time. And that was enabled partly by this 100-year time span. It was just beyond one's lifetime, but not too far that we wouldn't be able to kind of conceive of those future recipients. But by 1930s, we have time capsules that reach out across much longer time spans, 5,000 years or more. And although, these are obviously kind of challenge, they present challenges of, you know, how to kind of preserve documents over that kind of time. They also depersonalize the conception of posterity. So it's much harder to imagine the future recipient. And instead, you just get endless reels of microfilm and statistics about the present, that you lose that sense of an ethical connection across time.
No, I was very interesting, because I was thinking, as soon as the corporations sort of take over, they create what they believe is their sort of utopian futures. But as you refer to them, these closed futures, it takes away from earlier when you're talking about these letters that are written, this hope that we see. It just, as soon as the corporations come in and this sort of capitalism takes over, it moves us away. Even the images are these, you know, we move from these sort of small time capsules to these giant vaults, right, where things are being stored in these giant vaults, as opposed to more personal aspects. So it's really fascinating to see sort of that movement and that push.
Yes, and I think also it's about size, and it's also about number of feet of microfilm, and you know, how many words they can cram into whatever space they have. And what you don't get are the kind of personalized messages, the essays that people were commissioned to write back in 1900 on various topics. You don't get any kind of personal accounts. Instead, they're microfilming from mainly from Encyclopedia Britannica in the case of the Westinghouse time capsule. So they're not even, you know, putting pen to paper themselves. They're just essentially microfilming existing texts.
And so you end right with the sort of opening of these time capsules and sort of breaking the seal. So do you want to talk a little bit about that, about what you found? Because some of it was not as dramatic as you would think it would be.
Right. Well, I keep the reader in suspense about the fate of each of these time capsules. And so the first six chapters tell the history of these time capsules from 1876 to 1939. And then finally, in chapter 7, I reveal their fate. And interestingly, although people who put those time capsules together in those earlier periods, they fantasized about, you know, glorious reception ceremonies with kind of the whole city or nation or the whole world following the opening of a time capsule beamed across the planet. And then they also imagine historians in ecstasy as they opened these boxes and found these incredible sources. But their actual reception was the complete opposite. They encountered, first of all, the problems of forgetting. So time capsules got lost, and people never knew where they were, or they forgot where they were located, or they forgot that they even existed to begin with. And then also, when they do get opened, you have a kind of sense of indifference or perhaps condescension of spectators and the officials who opened them, a sense of disappointment about what they contained. And so I look at the various ways in which time capsules fail to achieve their perspectives. Yet I emphasize at the end of that chapter how, although we tend to see the time capsule as filled with trivial documents or banal artifacts, if we read them against the grain, as I try to do in the book, they reveal so much about how groups in the past struggled over the politics of memorialization and the implications of new media, over social struggles, and so on. So I use that chapter to tie some things together and explore the kind of limits of time capsules as well as the possibilities.
It's just fascinating. I was thinking, I have a 9-year-old and she loves to get these toys that you open and there's a surprise in them, right? And when I was reading this, and I lived in Philadelphia for a while, so I love that the Philadelphia, like, people had these ideas, like they thought the original Liberty Bell would be in there, whatever it might be. And what's going to be in there is very different than what is in there. So this sort of anticipation, and sometimes the letdown, but having to sort of think about, like, what is actually in there versus what they're hoping to have in there, and the big open. It made me think of also the vault that Geraldo Rivera opened. I can't even think of. There was a big vault that he opened in the late 80s, early 90s, live on television, and there was nothing in it.
Okay.
Right. That.
Oh, yes, there have been cases of that. The hoax. It's a right. Hoax against the present.
And so, so what do you think? I'll ask you one more question about this. We've been talking for a while, and you sort of end with this epilogue of the futures of the time capsule. So can you talk a little bit about, like, the futures of the time capsule and what you think the time capsule means for now and sort of memory now, especially with the technology that exists in the world?
Yes, I didn't want to end on a totally negative note with the Westinghouse time capsule. So what I do in the epilogue is trace the subsequent development, variety of approaches and attitudes to time capsules since 1940. And I acknowledge the ways in which corporations and actually also space agencies, in the case of NASA, stretched the these kind of ambitions of the time capsule with ever greater time spans and larger payloads for these time capsules. In a way to kind of show off their new technologies. But by the 1970s, you see kind of a reaction against those kind of very ambitious kind of transmillennial time capsules. And the reaction comes from a variety of sources. One is a sense of one is a critique of the kind of the hubris of these projects and the kind of essentialism whereby corporations claim to be able to represent all of humanity. But also we get a reaction with the rise of more vernacular time capsules. So especially during the bicentennial, we see people all across the country burying things in their backyards. So I want to kind of emphasize how, although the time capsule gets kind of appropriated by corporations, it's still continuing to kind of mutate in interesting ways, and it will continue to do so with the internet revolution and the rise of digital time capsules. And of course, there are negative tendencies in all of these, the kind of the solipsism of time capsules that we do to ourselves over the internet. You know, there are various websites that allow you to send a message to yourself in the future. I want to also emphasize that the time capsule still has potential for a kind of a politics of hope. And I show how environmentalists and artists have tried to reinvigorate the time capsule and use it as a tool for raising a sense of, what the earlier time capsule advocate called posteritism, a respect for future generations. And so I think it's important to remember that although we tend to see time capsule ceremonies getting conducted in exactly the same way every year, it seems like it's become very formulaic and repetitive. You know, there's a precise way of doing it, a protocol, and it's repeated endlessly. I think it's really important to reinvent the time capsule, and artists have helped us do that and finding different ways to kind of to vary this project.
Yes, I have to say, I lived in Norway for a year, then just got back about 6 months ago, and it made me very happy that you ended with the Future Library and that idea of this Margaret Atwood book sitting there that no one will read, no one that I know right now will probably read it, but this beautiful idea of art and history and also environmental, right? There's a big ceremony every time these books are handed over and these trees being planted in this forest. So that time capsule is really lovely.
Yes, I think it's a fascinating project, but particularly the connection between conserving these unread manuscripts of novels to the forest that would need to be planted in order to publish those and to print those books 100 years from now. So that's the real point. It's not the Margaret Atwood novel and all the other novels that are contributed every year, one each year. They're just the kind of the bait that get us kind of fascinated with it. But the real message is in the cultivation of the natural world, cultivation of forests.
Right. And so we've talked about this for a while. Do you have anything you're working on now that you'd like to share or mention?
Sure. I'm working on, not on time capsules anymore, but I'm working on a project that was done around 1900. It was a photographic survey of Broadway, the whole length of Broadway from the bottom of Manhattan all the way to the top. And it was done by an amateur photographer and documenting all the things that were being erased from Broadway when the subway boom took place around 1904. And so it kind of combines my early interest in ruins, because Broadway seems to be a kind of a scene of ruins and relics and holdouts that are being, you know, gradually erased. So it's a combination of ruins and perhaps time capsules, in the sense that these photographic albums, there were three volumes of photographs, haven't seen the light of day for almost 100 years. So it is a kind of a time capsule of New York history.
Wonderful. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you. Again, this was Nick Yablon, who wrote Remembrance of Things Present, The Invention of the Time Capsule. Nick, thanks for being with me. This again is Rebecca Buchanan, co-host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture.
Thank you.